Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/ACAST, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/ACAST.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it? Podcast like it's 1999.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it?
1999.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from the bridge of the NSEA Protector here in 2021. I am one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phyllis Gove.
And with us today, in the future, I guess, because we're recording this in 2020, but it is going to be our first episode of 2021, is Felicia Day, writer, director, actor, and streamer, and so many other things. Google her, motherfuckers. It's nice to see you, Felicia.
I'm going to ask if we could swear, but clearly not. Hey, I've never directed. That's I'm saving that for a debut direction.
Did you tell me producer?
Producer.
Yeah, no. Producer.
Well, you know.
I mean, I guess I've directed pretty much like hundreds of videos where I just jump cut my own face. I guess that's directing, right?
That's what I was talking about. Exactly. All right. It's so good to have you on. Thank you so much for doing this and coming on to talk with us about Galaxy Quest. It is one of kind of the tentpole movies for us. One of the movies that makes this year so special. And it's not really like anything else that came out this year. So we're so happy to have you.
Have there been a lot of Ashley Judd movies you've covered? Didn't she work a lot in 99?
Well, she did Double Jeopardy.
Yeah.
But we did Double Jeopardy, else, though?
She feels like she's very prolific during that time. Yeah.
I think there's something else forthcoming. I think there's something like Eye of the Beholder.
Oh, yeah. Eye of the Beholder. The Ewan McGregor. Yeah.
Was he naked in that one?
She was very big in the early 2000s.
Because I remember he was very naked in the early 2000s as well.
I don't remember that, not for any real reason. But I remember Trainspotting. You got a nice little glimpse.
Feature? The filming player. Debut of Mr. Wiggles. Mr. Wiggles.
Mr. Wiggles. So yes, we're one for two in Ashley Judd, and this is our second Tim Allen movie because we've already done Toy Story 2.
It is.
Wow, Toy Story 2. This was a good year for movies.
Oh my goodness! Movies. Yeah, it really
unbelievable
is
unbelievable year. And we're so thankful to have you on for this one, which is obviously it's a big fan favorite. It's a big movie in 99. You know, we've been doing this for what, almost over 3 years now, Kenny? We've been doing this, and this is one that we've held on to for a while because we wanted to, you know, make sure that we could get the best guest we could. And you, and you're really just, we couldn't have asked for a better guest for this movie.
Go on.
But just to rewind a little bit, Felicia, do you remember where you were in 1999 and if you saw this film around then?
I was in college. I'd graduated in 2000. So that I'm aging myself, but I did graduate. But I went to school when I was 16. So I was young. So I was probably, I don't even know how I was, like 19? Anyway, so I don't know how to add. I only got a math degree, guys. Oh, my God. So I was in college, and I took like 24 hours a semester because my mom made me live at home with her and drive me to school. So, like, I didn't have a social life. So I basically played video games and did 24 hours of credits a semester, and I ended up getting, like, you know, a couple of degrees and a bunch of half degrees. So I don't say that like movie consumption was not high on my list. I remember watching Friends, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in all of the South, but I went to UT Austin. So
nice,
Austin, Texas.
As so I was did really, past and future guest Allison Akel also went to, I believe, UT Austin.
A lot of alumni in Austin. And there was a big film scene there because I got into the film business by volunteering at the Austin Film Festival in South by Southwest. And that's where I met a bunch of people from LA. And I was like, I know three screenwriters. I'm going to have a huge career as an actor. Yep.
That's how it works.
That's how it works. So you didn't see this film around its release, but you have subsequently seen this film, I'm assuming.
Of course, yes. But I did rewatch it for this to refresh myself.
Sure.
And I got immersed, and I was like, this is a really excellent movie. Like, just down the line, it is well crafted in every single way.
Mm-hmm. It's also just, you know, there are a lot of movies made about fans, you know? Mm-hmm. But this movie, I feel like the beating heart of this movie is a love of fandom and wanting desperately to give fans the illusion or the reality that the thing they love is real, that it's not just, you know, some sort of a fantasy, which is maybe the thing that I love most about it.
I mean, 100%. Like, it's surprising because, like, if you look at, like, the secondary characters and, like, the extras, I feel like they did a better job at diversity in this show. In this movie, like 20 years ago, than people do nowadays. I do agree with that. And then also it's like an inside look at acting and actors in a way. Mm-hmm. So it's all this inside looks, but they were able to make inside accessible, which is really hard. And that's why, great. And the great special effects. And it's just funny as hell. It's like a really good movie.
It's a very, very good movie. It's also threading a lot of needles. You know, you were sort of talking about or alluding to like the metatextuality of it, the idea of these roles within roles, shows within shows, like that type of stuff can get very intellectual and can sort of, I don't want to say distract, but you know, you can lose an audience in that. But this movie does it so seamlessly in making sure that people are in on the joke. You know, if you know of Star Trek, this is going to work for you, but also finding layers for people that are diehard fans of it as well.
Yeah, it's almost like you want this template to be every video game movie that ever wasn't. Because I can't name one that's good, right? Let's just be honest. There's not one that's good.
We've done this. Isn't there one that's good?
We tried this.
I think there might be one that's good.
Oh, what was the one?
None are good. None are good, though I thought Sonic was fine.
Yeah, Sonic was trash enough to be fine. But I hate Sonic anyway, so I didn't really... Yeah, I had a personal prejudice. Sonic is that kid who has gel in their hair that punches you and smells a little bit like crust.
Yeah, I know exactly who he is. He sucks.
That's so specific.
And he only has one skill. He's really fast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he's tricked the gym teachers into thinking he's a great athlete, but he's really just fast.
No. One trick pony.
I don't like Sonic very much either, but that's because I was a Nintendo kid, right? Like I always thought he was a bit of an interloper.
I was a Sega. I was a Sega kid. But I want to ask Felicia, since we're on the subject, why do you think video game adaptations have not worked up until this point?
Well, I think that, you know, it's I think inherently studio people don't understand anything about video games, like nothing. Okay. The executives have literally been like, oh, I played some Candy Crush and my kid mm-hmm. plays. And I don't have a relationship with them because I'm a Hollywood person whose nanny raises their child. So mm-hmm. that's that side. And then the other side is that video games don't need Hollywood. So they have a lot of creative control over their product because they frankly will make billions more dollars on their IP. And so they're super protective of their IP, but being a gamer means you need to be really inside your hardcore fans' heads. And so they probably wrest control of it too much in the opposite direction. And so you end up with this sort of like dumbed down mishmash of inside outside that nobody really cares about.
I think there's, I think you're 100% right, everything you said. I also think they have been given to, they've been ghettoized to some extent, right? Mm-hmm. Where the Marvel movies are made by the top, top, top people. And they're also made by people who really understand the IP. But yeah. when you look at the people who make these movies, and I'm not necessarily talking about the directors and the writers, but I'm talking about the studios and the execs. They're given to the people who don't have budgets, the people who are just looking to pump them out. And I think the best point you made is that the people who make them don't understand what the IP they're working with.
Yeah.
On top of that, you know, video games already contain within them so much richness that really good ones, I mean, that cannot be captured with a single narrative. Generally,
yeah, I agree with you. And also, you know, but if you look at Warcraft, like. That's a director who loves Warcraft. You mm-hmm. have a studio that kind of should have worked. And then it was probably the worst thing. I mean, like, so bad. Embarrassingly bad. And so it seemed like there were some creative decisions that were made that just were like, this is tanked and it's never going to get anywhere because of some creative decisions that look like they were made in the beginning. So mm-hmm. That's a sad situation where you're like, this should work. The teams all should work. So maybe I think actually doing video games, because people will be hundreds of hours in there. And then you want people to understand a hundreds of hours world with 1.5 hours or 2 hours or however long people watch movies. I don't watch movies lately, but because I'm just playing too many video games. But at the end of the day, maybe TV, I think TV shows, they're going to be doing a Fallout TV show. They're doing Assassin's Creed TV show. Like that's actually might work because you have the length of time that people will equivalently be in the world. I'm hoping
they're doing a Halo show as well, or trying to do a Halo.
We've been talking about that for 15 years. But that's the other thing. That's the other point. You can't serve both masters, even the way you can serve both masters with a comic book. You know, Marvel spent 20 movies building us up to the Infinity Stone story that was already written. That was already in comic book form. But you can't do what you're talking about by like distilling hundreds of hours of playable narrative into an hour and a half movie. And you also can't take one narrative from that 100 hours, put it into movie form and please the hardcore fans of the game. That's what I felt like happened with Detective Pikachu. I felt like Detective Ooh. Pikachu didn't really please anybody. I think it was inaccessible to people who had who had no knowledge of the game, and people who loved the game and loved this world thought it was for babies.
Yeah.
So
agree. No, I didn't. Well, the same thing. Assassin's Creed.
I have a question for you, Felicia, which
terrible.
I think.
Yep. Let's trash other movies. Oh, no, I'm just kidding. Go, go, go.
My question to you is, and it folds into this movie as well, and I don't want to get into the toxicity of fandom because, you know, it's gone to a dark place over the past few years, mm-hmm. but I do want to sort of get your feelings on the differences between sort of, you know, a Star Trek fandom or something of that ilk to video game fandom, which does feel different. Now, I don't know a ton about either of them, but I'm sort of curious as to whether or not you felt like this film sort of taps into that in the right way. I mean, it certainly does it in the most comedic and probably the most heartwarming way, but did you feel as though it was a accurate representation of fandom in that way? Did you feel as though, and sort of how that compares to video games?
You know, I think fandom is one of those things you can't really paint with one brush anymore.
Sure.
I think maybe 10 years ago, you could have this sort of cliched nerd geek kind of culture thing. And I was certainly on the forefront of that. Now, I think there's just not one kind of fan. You know, you have a lot of different aspects of all different fandoms. I mean, yes, people are hardcore Marvel fans or hardcore Naruto fans. They're hardcore video games. Like, and because there's so much content out there, people don't necessarily have to get out of their silo. Like, they are immersed in their fandoms, right? And so I think you have different angles on each. I think, you know, the one thing that you would share a little in video games, I think, tend to be more isolated amongst themselves, perhaps, because Star Wars is more of a casual thing that you could share with casual people. I mean, if a League person tries to get me into League of Legends, I'm just glazing over and I spend 20 hours a week playing video games, you know? So like, it really is more of a specialty in a sense, gaming. And I do think that their own communities tend to be more closed communities tend to be more white male isolated, and therefore you have that kind of toxicity that's particularly bad and kind of defines the internet now, unfortunately, in a lot of ways. I think things have gotten better the next couple of years, but certainly 4 or 5 years ago, the rise of and it obviously, I think it rubbed off on politics too, but it kind of reached its peak assholeness about 4 or 5 years ago.
Do you think that there's also, and Kenny and I talked a little bit about this when we talked about video games previously, but there's an interactive quality to it that makes it specialized to that one person, right? Like, they're going on that journey themselves. And because of that specificity, because of that sort of individualism of it, they take an ownership of that journey, right? Like, it feels like it's their own, as opposed to, you know, watching a Star Wars movie or watching a Star Trek television show where that story is told to you rather than you actually physically being a part of it. Does that have something to do with it as well?
Yeah, I think everybody, unless you are playing Mario or you're playing a character, Sonic, you are Sonic, then you're projecting yourself and your kind of customization of yourself into that world, right? And like, if I were to watch an Assassin's Creed, like, the lead guy is not me because I always play a woman, right? And so that's not my Assassin's Creed. So I think, but I do think, you know, like, I think when you offer an accurate ensemble, you know, with a bunch of different perspectives, like, I think Witcher had some issues, but I do think that offering the different perspectives that it did kind of covered a gamut of types of players in a way. So I think a good ensemble, like, if you did another D&D show, which I'm sure would not be good, unfortunately, but there would be a potential to create something like that, where you represent a lot of different kinds of aspects of people. I did that with the guild where you have six main characters, and I took a lot of archetypes that I've been and encountered in my life. And I think a lot of people either saw themselves or another person in them. And that was a fandom show, right? We're talking about gaming fandom. But at the end of the day, each person is able to say, like, the same thing with friends. I know a Joey. I know, you know, that's are good characters, right? You want, that's, I think, the heart of any show that a fan is going to be a fan of. Like, you have that kind of character ensemble of characters you can relate to and characters you can be friends with.
So, you know, you go ahead. Sorry, Kendall.
Felicia, did you, unless you want to keep going down this road, Phil, I just want to pivot to this movie. Are you a Star Trek fan at all? Do you have any history with Star Trek?
I do. I think I'm, yes, I am a Star Trek fan. I was totally obsessed with Next Generation when I was a kid. I was in love with Picard. We were going to have babies. Yeah, exactly. I also liked his second in command, which made it awkward when I was directed by Jonathan Frakes when I did an episode of Librarians.
I worked with Jonathan Frakes too. He's a lovely man.
He is very charming. He oozes charm.
Yeah.
He's an oozer in a good way. So, yes, I'm a big Star Trek. I was not an original Star Trek fan.
It does. It does feel like this movie, and J.J. Abrams has been pretty open about his love of this film. You can see this film having an impact on his Star Trek films for sure, just in terms of the kind of the winkiness and certainly the humor that exists within his version of Star Trek. I certainly felt that. I also would say aesthetically as well, it felt like it had a lot of similarities. I don't know if you guys did as well.
I didn't really like his films, so...
Okay.
I love them. They were fine.
Okay. I like the first one.
I like the first one.
It was okay.
But I do think that, you know, I should lay it all out. Star Trek, it's not that I don't like Star Trek. It's just that it didn't pierce my bubble when I was a child.
Right.
So speaking as someone who did not necessarily have the specificity of reference when I watched this movie, the things that I got were the things you were talking about earlier, like Felicia, like I got the life of the actor. the way actors are viewed. I love the idea that the commander within the, you know, world becomes the commander within. That happens all the fucking time. Where the guy, it's the most surreal thing, where the guy who plays the police captain becomes the leader of the group, where the guy who plays the principal becomes the leader of the group. That makes no sense. But that's people just these are, it's like, it's as silly as saying David Schwimmer and Courtney Cox couldn't date because they're brother and sister. Well, they could, I think. I'm pretty sure Dexter married his sister in real life, but that was so weird, right?
Yeah, and Peter Croce is dating Lauren Graham. They were brother and sister on Parenthood.
Nightmare. You know?
Gross.
But it is that. So I loved stuff like that in terms of the metatextuality. Mm-hmm. I don't, honestly, for me, it just works as a sci-fi film.
Yeah,
right? And I watched it last night. So I hadn't seen this movie in at least 15 years. So I didn't remember a lot of it. I watched it last night with my son. And when Tony Shalhoub comes in at the end and shoots them up, he looks at me and he's riveted by this movie. I was very nervous. He's riveted. He looks at me and goes, "That's how this movie ends?" And he grabbed my hand. He's 8. He grabbed my hand and then it killed everybody. And I'm like, you have to remember the Omega 13. They can go back 13 seconds. You have to. Like, it's not going to end like this. So it's there are very strong science fiction narrative elements going on in this movie that actually are effective. And the way, you know, they find their midpoint turn with them, you know, with him having to acknowledge that he wasn't really a captain. It's a really rock solid, flawlessly structured movie, aside from like the winky stuff, which works. And it's very funny, but that's not front and center, and that's something I just love about this movie.
No, I fully agree. I mean, I think that this movie has a lot of heart and emotion in it, and you know, the first scene, the scene at the beginning when they're at the convention and Tim Allen overhears those kids shit talking the show and him and how big of, like, which apparently, so legend says, William Shatner had a similar situation where he overheard some people talking poorly of him and the show and what have you. But you can see how much it hurts him and how much pride he has baked into this character and into this show. Mm-hmm. So for him to have to acknowledge that it's all an act when the circumstances are real. I mean, it's a really beautiful movie. Like it really works. Got a little,
it's very character based, and every character is served in a sense. And like, I think because it's so driven by character, like all the story points, I feel like now, I mean, a lot of movies are not like that. It's a bunch of characters going through plot and they don't really feel like friends. And the ending is spectacular, but I don't care. And I don't remember it 5 minutes later. Right. So I think it really is a testament to what's impactful to people, which is seeing people progress from an A to a B. I mean, it seems very simple, but for some reason, I think a lot of the times things are not as resonant. And watching this made me feel like I was in good hands.
Yeah, totally. People forgot how to make movies. People forgot how to make this kind of movie. And I said that to Phil when I was watching last night. What was the last movie like this? A very high concept studio film that's this effective. And, you know, it's funny because not to shit on one particular movie, but I just watched Tag with my son because I show him R-rated movies because I'm a bad father. And Tag is what you're talking about.
Which movie? Sorry, Kenny. Oh, Tag.
Tag is what you're talking about. It's a bunch of people going through plot where the movie tells you they're friends, but there's nothing that makes me think these people are friends.
No.
There's no shared experience. There's no personal history. There's no warmth. There's no comfort. It's just these people who I don't even understand why they'd be in the same room with each other, which I guess is part of the movie, but they to play tag, I guess. But
to me, I'm like, this is the Seth Rogen phenomenon, not to trash anybody, like, God bless have I ever been in that movie, any movie like that. Uh-huh. But there's a type of comedy that is the mainstream, and it's a bunch of white dudes being funny, and then they interchange the people of color and the women every movie, and they do movies together for 10, 15 years. And I'm like, I'm tired of it. Like, I don't want to see you and your dudes who smoke pot together every weekend. Let's go make a movie. I got an idea. Let's get another hot blonde chick to play your wife. They're the same every time. They don't have any loyalty to the women around them. They're just, except for a couple who happen to be married to people, which is like, that's your security as a job. And like that comedy has influenced all mainstream comedy for the last 10 years. And it's boring.
It's been longer and it is boring. And it's a problem. It's a problem when that, or I think that, you know, I think 40-year-old version works really well. I think Knocked Up works less well. And I think that a movie like 40-year-old version has every right to exist. And a movie like 40-year-old version, and I'm not saying you don't, but a movie like 40-year-old version, you know, is correctly held up as, you know, kind of a high watermark for comedy, for American comedy. It's frustrating that that's the kind of movie that everyone decided to emulate over and over again. And it's one thing, and it's one thing of Seth, and I think Seth Rogen's even tired of it because now he's making movies like American Pickle, which are closer to Galaxy Quest.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's frustrating when people who aren't those people, basically every white guy between the ages of 20 and 40 in this town, decide this is the way to do it. Mm-hmm. You forget that there's more than just a premise, more than 40-year-old guy can't get laid, more than...
Yeah, there was great character in that. That's a character-based comedy. And it's a bunch of executives wanting to hang out with Seth and smoke pot with them. Let's greenlight it. And then the women are like, well, that's what my boss wants, so let's greenlight that. And then you're like women comedy ghetto, or you're a stoner comedy with the same five dudes over and over again. And you're totally right. It's a disservice to the audience, and it makes us not excited to go to the movies, to be honest with you. I have not been excited about a comedy in years.
And fortunately, we have television. Where, you know, where exciting things have been happening, not just female led, but POC led too, right? So you have, I mean, this isn't new, but you have Fleabag and you have Girls and you have Atlanta and you have Raimi and you have all these things that are different, and are also character based. It's not just enough to say, you know, we're putting people who look different. Like, there's actually like depth and feeling. So, yeah, I think that I think Phil and I are very much on the train that the modern cinematic experience outside of spectacle is lacking. Outside of spectacle and in indie, I would say, and you know, ulterior driven indie stuff. But
yeah,
I would also say too, you know, all of this points to how deep the bench is on the cast of this movie as well. I mean, this movie is filled out with so many incredible character actors. I mean, your Sam Rockwell's, your Tony Shalhoub's, you know, obviously Sigourney Weaver, Alan Rickman. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily put Tim Allen in that, but he's very good in this movie, playing a role that he should be good at, which is sort of a puffed up chest kind of person. But I was watching this film yesterday, and I tweeted this yesterday too, but like, Tony Shalhoub should be in everything. He is just,
oh my God, he's so good. And I did an episode of Monk. He's the nicest person you have ever met in your whole entire life. It was, he's incredible. Just the first look he does when the camera zooms in on him, I'm like, he needs an award just for that look in his eye. That is good acting.
I wanted more of that. I wanted more of 1982 Shalhoub.
There's just moments where he says nothing and he's funny, where he's just eating out of the cheese, out of that little cheese snack thing in the ship as they're going down to the planet. And just the glee on his, like, he just seems like it's all just a blast for him. You know, just even lines like the ship's falling apart, just FYI.
You know what I love about that performance so much is I've seen so many things with, you know, quote unquote, like the washed up actor, you know, who's bitter or who's vain or who's, you know, angry or whatever. I've never actually met those people. I've met a lot of washed up actors who are just super fucking nice and super fucking happy that they had their shot and super fucking happy that they can go to a convention and make good money. Like, I, you know, I've met so, you know, you work in TV, you see these people all the time. They're all fucking just cool. You're just like, you won't believe how cool that guy is. You won't believe how cool that guy is. And I sleep to like the marriage of actor and role, because I think you go either one of two ways. You hire someone who's a lot broader for a role like that, usually, or you change the characterization of that and make them more bitter. But they really, really nailed that like archetype, which I've never
seen. It's also, I mean, this was, I would argue this was a star-making performance from Sam Rockwell. This felt like the movie that kind of put him on
the
map.
So good.
And he's fantastic in it. He almost turned it down, apparently, because he wanted to do an indie film. But of all people, Kevin Spacey is the one who convinced him to do it. We just won't talk about that. But I'll just say that in this movie, Sam Rockwell is so funny and so just perfectly tuned to the role.
He's the plucky comic relief.
He's gleeful. Yeah. And I've seen him. I went to Sundance every year for many years up until like 2007 or whatever. And like he was in like four movies every time. Sure. And I was like, I forgot that Sam Rockwell was funny and had this amazing like sprightly quality about him. It was so good. Also, Rainn Wilson is in one scene
in a
limo. And he never comes back. I'm like, did he get fired? Was he just limo guy number three? What happened? Baby Rainn Wilson, what happened? Him. Did he get renowned? Rain.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Sam Rockwell's just tremendous in this movie. So funny. Remember, he was also in Midsummer's Night Dream this year.
Yeah, that's right. He was.
And he did a great job in that too.
Well, not briefly
because he was in the Pyramus Methysbe performance. Yeah. So he was so great in that. I mean, I don't think modern Sam Rockwell. I think people think of modern Sam Rockwell and they think, you know, three billboards and a guy who plays a very specific type of blue collar ish character. But he is so much depth.
He's so funny. And in the next year, he's in Charlie's Angels as, you know, the villain in that one, which I think he does quite well because you kind of don't expect it from him. He's fantastic. I mean, this is one of those movies that, you know, obviously I did a little bit of reading on its gestation a little bit. It was supposed to be directed by Harold Ramis, and he wanted it to be Steve Martin. He first wanted Alec Baldwin to play the Tim Allen role, which makes sense. But he turned it down. Then he wanted Steve Martin or Kevin Kline, neither of which feel totally right for me. Then Tim Allen attaches, and that's when Ramis leaves the film. When
Tim Allen comes, you got to go.
And then Dean Pariseau comes on, and obviously he directs the film. Sigourney Weaver, she had to convince him to give her the role because obviously, you know, this is a little bit outside Sigourney Weaver's lane. She's phenomenal in it, but I can understand why someone might be like blonde, buxom, starlet. Like it's not necessarily her lane.
I'm so glad that they
she's great.
Did it because she actually has, if they had just gone with a blonde bimbo 1999 actress, then it would have been a disappointment because then that's all she is, right? And she has so many layers to her. Yep. Just in her presence. So she is that character. It was just so perfect. And I forgot about that with her breasts hanging out all the time. And I'm but thank God they didn't go that Porky's direction. They just went, she's sexy as all hell. And then she has so much behind it. It's such a better decision.
I would also say too, the age thing was right. My fear is that, and I don't mean this to sound bad, and maybe it will, but like Heather Graham feels like the person that they would have put in that role necessarily, who's you know very beautiful and can kind of play that role, that kind of ditzy blonde whatever role, and is 15 years too young to be with Tim Allen. Whereas at least these two felt age appropriate, and she's amazing in the role. I mean, she's fantastic.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
She also apparently
dish. Phil, this is you.
I was just going to say that, and it's just a funny piece of trivia. Yeah, I know. There's such a funny piece of trivia that I appreciated, which is that according to Sigourney Weaver, Tim Allen was bugging her to sign a piece of the Nostromo, the ship from the Alien films, because he's a huge Alien fan. When she eventually did at the end, and she wrote, "Stolen by Tim Allen, loves Sigourney Weaver," and it really pissed him off because she ruined his piece of memorabilia, which I think is great.
Tim Allen is, you know, an interesting guy. Tim Allen is an interesting guy. It's hard to kind of wrap my head around the Tim Allen experience. You know, I'll tell the story very briefly.
Please.
I was at a little New Year's Day party for my dad's friend. And at this party, of all people, is Tim Allen. And Tim Allen is, you know, like just standing in the corner, sunglasses on, hanging out with the, you know, the tray of food. And I'm texting Phil. I'm like, Tim Allen is here. Should we try to get him on the podcast? And Phil's like, yes, 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 of course. And I'm like, well, you know, that's better said than done. I was joking mostly. So I didn't really have the guts to do anything. So the first thing I did was I took my little 8-year-olds over, the 8-year-old twins. And I knew I can get in there by saying, you know, they're Santa Claus fans. And he was wonderful with them. He's like, guys, turn around. Because they didn't know who he was. He turned around and he goes, to infinity and beyond. That's and they great. Immediately, yeah, it was great. So they immediately were like, oh my God, it's Buzz Lightyear. They turn around, Santa Claus, yeah, yeah. So then I'm hanging out with my daughter, Layla, and I'm like, Layla, would you go and like ask Buzz Lightyear if he would be on my podcast? And she's like, sure, why not?
What? So,
this is all real. So my daughter goes up to Tim Allen. And she asks, will you be on my dad's podcast? And he's like, well, what's the podcast? She's like, it's a podcast like it's 1999. They talk about the movies in 99 from here at a New Year's Day party. And he goes, well, he goes, yeah, sure. So she comes back with Tim Allen's office phone number and says,
wow.
Yeah. And he gives me like a thumbs up. And then I never had the guts to call.
Well, you're gonna call him, Kenny. We're gonna make this happen.
This was this New Year, so this was right before COVID.
You're almost from outside the issue, the time limit. You got to get in on this.
He's a lovely man. I've heard very bad things about him, but he's a lovely man. And we did talk a little about Galaxy Quest, and the one thing he said was it's his favorite movie he ever did. They talk all the time, apparently. The cast are all very good friends, he says. And when they were on set, they knew it was – or they believed it was a masterpiece. They believed that they were doing something really special while it was happening, which made me feel good because, you know, I always – and Felicia, you could talk to this obviously as a person who's been in films and movies and shows. I always am concerned that something that seems silly on the page and seems silly when you're in wardrobe and seems silly when you're in makeup – how do you convince yourself that something that, you know, where you have to wear an Alan Rickman like, you know, head prosthetic is not a joke on you and not the kind of thing you're going to be made fun of in your, you know, in on a late night show. And it actually is something that can turn into, you know, an iconic performance, which I would say like this is one of Alan Rickman's like four or five most iconic performances.
He's incredible. Yeah. I mean, listen, you work because you need health insurance and you like what you do. I mean, like we could probably all be making, I don't know if we'll be making more money. We'd probably make the equivalent, most actors at least, doing something else. So if it becomes a grind, listen, I've had some our show guest stars I've taken because boy, oh boy, I need that, you know, that health insurance. And like, you're just hating every moment. But then I've had amazing experiences where I'm friends with the whole cast, like Buffy, Supernatural, like I'll talk to those people forever. Right. So, or the stuff that I've made, I have friendships forever. So the weird thing about movies is it can be a grind and awful, or it could be like incredibly fulfilling. And that's why we're here. It's almost like one day, you know, you can do five bad jobs. You're like, I know the next one around the corner. It's going to make me feel awesome about my life choices. And so, you know, you just have to have faith that if you're having fun and you feel activated and you're doing the best work you can and you're like enjoying yourself, then you're doing a good job. And it didn't feel like anybody here was not just loving going to rehearsal, loving doing take 17 or whatever. But that said, I heard that the people who are on the set of Cats really thought they were making a masterpiece. So I, you know, and that might be the worst thing I've ever seen in my life in a good way. Like I want to see the butthole cut
in
such a bad way that I'm like, who can hook me up? So at the same time,
never know. That movie is hypnotizing in the strangest way. It really is. Yeah.
Who could watch it and be like, this is like, I'm just like you. It's almost like being in some kind of weird Trump bubble. And like,
although like, I wish I could have been there in the moment when Tom Hooper realizes like I've made a terrible mistake. Like, I just wish I could have been there in that moment where he's like, oh God, there's
when
no way
out. That
like,
was.
The first previous?
It must be the previews, right?
I don't know. It could have been on set. It could have been day one. I'm not even kidding. It could have been on set. It could have been like, I don't know about this. All right, so I've already spent $80 million. I have to spend another $120 to get where I need to get. Oh, what a nightmare. I do not subscribe, and Phil knows this. I do not subscribe to the cats is cute thing at all. Like, I hate it with the fury of a billion suns. I think it's such, like, the thing that bothers me about, like, the cult of cats, and I understand it's all ironic, is like, this doesn't deserve irony. This is the most cynical fucking play of all time. And it deserves to go down in a heaping flame of cat hair.
Here's the thing. You can't fault any of the actors, because an actor, I would have loved being on the set. Like, you're an actor and you're used to doing crazy thing on stage. You're like, oh my God, I get to do crazy ass stuff on a movie. This is a revolution. I feel fulfilled as an artist for the first time in my life. I'm singing, you know, I'm dancing. We're appreciating, we're showing people beautiful dancing for once. And then but you're right. Like, why were they so small on the railroad tracks? That's the one that I just don't understand.
The scale just changed all the time. I will say this, though. I remember when they announced that they were doing it, in my head, I was like, well, this is going to be terrible. Like, this is a bad idea. You shouldn't do this, right? Like,
well, the best version is terrible.
It's bad, right. But then I was like, when the trailer came out and I watched the trailer, I was like, it's so much worse than I ever could have possibly imagined. Made it so much better for me. Because I was just like, this isn't just a failure. This is just an unmitigated disaster. Yeah. And everyone looks insane. It's like a fever dream of I don't know.
What other movie of this proportion could you say, oh my God, about? Like, really? What other movie?
Is that a rhetorical question?
Yeah, like Space Jam. Like, what is something you're just like, whoa?
Space Jam's amazing. Something that's so crazy.
Space Jam just getting thrown out there is like, that's the before Cats, it was Space Jam. We all shit.
I think what she means.
You know who's happy Cats is here? Michael Jordan, because he's so tired of getting shit all over Space Jam.
I think what Felicia was getting at, and I don't want to put words in her mouth, but I think that, is that the leap of technology and what they were trying to do, which is, I think, more akin to like a Who Framed Roger Rabbit maybe than to Space Jam, but like, this could be a disaster and not work at all. Mm-hmm. And these two things might not speak to each other.
Oh, and then I got the answers.
Okay. Yeah.
Kind of. Oh, you don't know. Oh, I got one. Okay. Yeah, Polar Express.
That's what I was going to say.
Abomination.
All right. So, I was going to say the Zemeckis, exactly. I was going to say that and Beowulf and the fucking...
Oh, Beowulf! Christmas I forgot Carol. About Beowulf!
And Christmas Carol.
Beowulf is the craziest because...
Beowulf is the craziest.
It's crazy. Like, it's at crazy. Least Polar Express and Christmas Carol built an audience. Yeah. You are going to see it no matter what, like, lazy parents who are just trying to, like, get some peace for 2 hours. Who the fuck is going to watch Beowulf? Creeps who want to see, like, half-naked monster Angelina Jolie... Motion cap? Okay. So I do have yes, I think you're totally right. I think Polar Express was that. And by the way, I don't think we were on camera when you said that Phil looks a little bit like Sid from
you're looking like Toy Sid Story. From Toy Story a little bit
but,
right now.
But trying to render humans in the 90s in was not CG was kind of that too. Where it was go away.
Well, there's a couple of video games, like there's L.A. Noire, which is one of a really great video game.
Yeah, I remember
but
that.
Unfortunately, it just doesn't work. You know, just technologically, it was not good. And that's kind of where I feel maybe that kind of lies.
But I would say with Cats, the difference between Cats and Space Jam and Roger Rabbit and even the Zemeckis stuff, which is closer to me, is they could have done better. Like, this wasn't really a failing of the technology as much as it was a failing of, like, oh my God, how'd you get that picture of Phil behind you?
I look better than that kid.
Your teeth are
Felicia
better.
Has just put Sid as her background.
Yeah.
I mean, all right. I mean, that's fine. Can I will, to your point, Kenny, because I agree with you, I want to say this. I think that what happened, because I read some stuff about the production of Cats, obviously, and that at a certain point, Universal, like, close the purse strings. Like, they were like, we're not giving you any more money to do this stuff. So some of the close-ups, the fur isn't on their faces at all because, quite frankly, they just couldn't afford to do it. There's just stuff that they just, at a certain point, were like, fuck it. Like, it's erase, good enough.
Erase the buttholes and put it out.
Erase the buttholes and get it out into the, the masses are dying for it.
I'll never forget the moment where you think it's over. I'm like, you get some memories and you're like, oh, she ruined the one reason I want to watch this movie. Why is there so much snot? Just rein it in. That's the only reason to watch this movie is that song.
So much snot.
And then you go farther. And then you're just like, then you're like, okay, this is over finally. They cut to Judi Dench wearing another cat. And she does a 12-minute monologue to the camera with a
straight to lens
smile.
Straight down the barrel of the lens, where just like 20 minutes of cat Judi Dench just talking right at me.
I've never almost rage quit a movie. I almost walked out. I was so angry. I was like, how dare you?
I did, in fact, walk out of Cats.
At what point, though?
With his kids.
I went with my kids. My daughter was very excited. And to this day, they keep they keep telling me, like, why did you do that to me? Why did you put me through that? I said three days ago, I said to my daughter, have you ever seen a bad movie? She goes, yeah, Cats. So, we walked out like halfway through, right around when like Ian McKellen was lapping at a bowl of milk at like chin level. Like that. I think they're like, no, enough. But I did catch, like the last monologue a couple nights ago at like, 12 o'clock on HBO or something. So I can really, it's awful. But like, I also would say, I kind of, I'm going to contradict myself, but like, you're right, Phil. It is mesmerizing. Like the little puns that they, all the little cat puns that they have, it's awful and the worst thing you'll ever see in your life and mesmerizing in its weirdness.
To me, I feel like I wish they had just filmed it on stage. Like then just put a bunch of cameras up there, get some close-ups, maybe do some matte paintings behind a couple of people. Like, that's it. And like,
just put them in the furry leotards like they were on the goddamn stage and just own it. I
own
agree with you 100%.
This is a stage thing. Other than that, or have them be real CGI Pixar cats.
That's what I would have done.
So two quick things, and then we'll talk about Galaxy Quest. But two quick things. The first is I watched a little bit of it on HBO Max the other day just because I was like, oh, I mean, and it opens in such a like almost cats. Kubrickian cats. Like it almost feels like Clockwork Orange, like the lighting and the music. It's very unsettling. Like it starts from a very unsettling place.
Sexually, it's very unsettling through the whole thing.
Well, there's that too. Because they're all rubbing each other's groins against each other through most of the movie. Crazy.
I don't like seeing dogs hump people's legs. It's one of the most repulsive things I've ever done. That's the sensation that I get when I see a small dog humping a person's leg. And then somebody's like, they're so randy. I'm like, disgusting. I don't want to see it. That's the emotion I felt for 2 hours when I watched that movie. Yeah.
So I went to see it. They did at the Alamo, they did a rowdy screening of it so you could talk through it, which was, I ultimately believe, the only way that that film should be seen in a theater. And they had the drinks were all milk-based drinks in cat dishes that you would drink out of. Like it was, they really went all out.
Wow.
But the best part, one of the best parts was the moment you mentioned, Kenny, where Ian McKellen laps milk out of a dish. Someone in the audience screamed, "What a fucking pro."
That's good.
So I'm going to give a synopsis of Galaxy Quest for our listeners who might not have seen the film.
I want to say one more thing.
The stars of a 1970s sci-fi show.
I want to say one more thing. Felicia, the way you feel about dogs humping legs is the way I feel about mixed milk-based drinks.
Oh.
Milk is disgusting to me if you can see it. So it's like I can't even like the idea that you have a whole movie where all the characters have to drink milk is so gross to me.
I will tell you something. The one thing that makes me not love my daughter a little bit is when she drinks used cereal milk. She drinks it with such relish.
It's the best part.
We're done here. That's the end of this podcast.
It's the grossest thing. I would rather see somebody lick some snot.
Me too. No question. I will not podcast with a cereal milk drinker. I can't believe you mimed it. Ladies and gentlemen, he mimed it.
Anyway,
he's a two-hander.
don't get Kenny started on cheese either, Felicia. Hates cheese.
You have a lactose issue, huh?
Well, I can like eat anything. I like ice cream. I won't drink. I won't eat it once it's it's melted.
Oh God, eating melted ice cream. My daughter does that. I'm like, I love you, but right now it's hard.
Yeah.
Wait, that's I don't understand.
You're crazy, Phil.
I don't understand what's happening right now.
I eating ice cream for me is a race. Because if it actually starts melting, it's done. I will throw
100%,
it out.
I'm on your side. Yeah, I do love cheese, but I'm 100% on your side.
Can I ask? I have a question since we're talking about this. But what about cream-based soups?
I have a texture Rubicon Valley akin to Beowulf when you're between a smoothie and sort of a instant potato kind of like a texture. That is when I will vomit onto you. So yeah, like too. A vichyssoise.
Cream of mushroom soup.
It needs to be way watery.
Leek or potato soup? All right. Well, this episode definitely holds the record of dry heaving on Mike, I think.
Also, how happy I am. This is the happiest I've ever been.
For once, you have an ally.
Nobody agrees with my crazy shit, but like, this is human nature. You shouldn't be eating this disgusting gruel. It's like, this is what Oliver Twist is about. How food of that texture is not fit for human consumption. Literally, that's it.
If it's either me or cream of wheat of dying, I'll probably just, bye.
That's how I feel. I'm not even kidding. That's how I feel.
All right. I'm going to give the synopsis of Galaxy Quest. The stars of a 1970s sci-fi show, now scraping a living through reruns and sci-fi conventions, are beamed aboard an alien spacecraft. Believing the cast's heroic on-screen dramas are historical documents of real-life adventures, the band of aliens turn to the alien celebrities for help in their quest to overcome the oppressive regime of their solar system. The movie was written by David Howard and Robert Gordon and directed by Dean Pariseau. It opened on December 24th, 1999 in fourth place. Against The Talented Mr. Ripley, Any Given Sunday, and The Green Mile. It would go on to make $90 million on a $45 million budget. Galaxy Quest has 90% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 79% from audiences. So when you saw this film, Felicia, whenever that might very well have been, did you like it back then? Did it leave an impression on you back then? I mean, what was...
I thought it was funny. I love comedy. I'm not an actor because I want to cry and get an Oscar. You know, sure. I've had to cry a lot in my, I could, but that's not what, I mean, I love making people laugh. Now at the time I was told that I was a dramatic actress. It wasn't until I moved to LA and did improv that I was like, oh, I could do comedy. Even though every single thing I ever loved from like Family Ties to like every sitcom in the world was my favorite. Right. So I think that comedy and comedy movie, you know, movies that were comedies were really important to me. At the time, I was not like a fan person, you know, like I make part of my living doing conventions and like it's been a huge part of my career and my life and I love them so much. So revisiting this, because I saw this movie before all this happened in my career and it's been a long time. So like seeing it now, I'm like, oh, this is really a love letter and it's very respectful and it's not needing to deconstruct this and it's not. Mm-hmm. It's not marginalizing fandom in a way that I thought, oh, this is really cool. It's really before its time in a way.
Yeah. I texted Kenny this, but it really is a Valentine to the fans. It's a Valentine to Star Trek. It's clearly a love letter. The people that made this love this world. It's not sarcastic. It's not, the heart of this movie, I think that if this movie was made today, and Lord knows if this film would even be made today, quite honestly,
I feel like
it would be jaded. I feel like it would be sarcastic. I feel like it wouldn't have the sort of just wearing its heart on its sleeve that this film has.
It wouldn't be kind. There's a lack of kindness. And I'm sure that some of the people would have like crazy weird kinks. One would be a furry. There'd be some humping, you know, like it would have to be
thing.
Exactly. A dog dry humping another dog person.
Alien of some sort.
Older.
Yeah.
Oh, dog alien. Yeah. So it would be in the tone that would be much more jaded and much more like edgy, which everything doesn't need to be edgy without being saccharine. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like there isn't just one tonality. And I feel like everything's in a category comedy wise now. It's just kind of sad.
Well, Kenny, I actually, What I was going to say is that if in the spectrum of the comedies that we got in 99, you know, we have Being John Malkovich, we have Election, but we also have Big Daddy. We also have South Park. Like the spectrum of it is pretty broad, but I think this film falls squarely in the middle of all of that in the best possible way. But I don't know what you think.
It's the best, it's the platonic ideal of a studio comedy. And what I mean is, so the word edgy gets thrown around a lot. And I think edgy is often used, like executive speak, as a stand-in for cool. And I think all anyone really wants in this business is to be cool, for the most part. It's just and I don't necessarily even think that's a bad thing, right? Like that in and of itself isn't bad, because the word cool doesn't have a negative connotation or any kind of connotation other than, you know, it's just kind of confident. And if you really break that down, the coolest thing you can do is make a good movie. Right? Straight up. The coolest thing you can do is make a good movie. There is nothing inherently cool about Pixar. Pixar is inherently very uncool. You know, like it's inherently about emotions. It's generally about family. It's about relationships. It's about adventure growing up and being scared and getting over it. All these things, feeling-y things that aren't cool. But what's cool is making a really good movie. So what I love about Galaxy Quest is,
hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
It avoids all the obvious targets, right? Like making fun of quote unquote nerds and fanboys and things like that, or even making fun of the aliens, who would be a very obvious target because they're, you know, they're ultimately they have just lost a big battle and they're kind of socially awkward and all these things. They don't pick on any of those things. They pick on the coolest people in the room. They pick on the people who are, you know, full of themselves, people who have been successful, the people who are vain. And it doesn't sacrifice any of the humor. Like, I guess something that kind of struck me, and it's always struck me about this movie, is this strikes me as a movie that when critics went into it, they probably didn't want to like it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Sure. That's interesting. Yeah.
They probably were like, Tim Allen, a Tim Allen movie, period. That's a strike against it. Sigourney Weaver in a broad comedy, probably not something they were feeling in 1999. Star Wars.
Alan Rickman in a broad comedy. What's that?
With that ridiculous head thing. Star Wars, not particularly cool in the culture at that point. No one was talking about Star Wars in 1999, right?
Well, so Star Trek.
Star Trek in 1999. No one was talking about Star Trek in 1999. And they were kind of like, you know, pointing a gun directly where a lot of these critics live, which is a lot of these critics were fans of Gene Roddenberry and that show. And they probably went in saying, like, this might be a shot directly at me. Mm-hmm. So to overcome all that and have 90% of Rotten Tomatoes and become kind of a critical darling and something that's endured through our culture is kind of remarkable to me. The only way to do it is just have a really fucking strong film.
Well, and I would also say too, and I want to get obviously all your opinions on the tone that they're striking in this is really tricky. I mean, they are really trying to thread a needle in terms of like the effects and the makeup and the production design are all in this space of being a little cheesy, but also sort of state of the art at times. All the makeup of the aliens, the evil aliens and their ship, that stuff looks incredible. But like the ship, like the bridge of their ship, kind of looks like shit. Like they try to find this balance of being able to thread that stuff. And I think the movie that came to mind as I was watching it was Men in Black,
which
also kind of is a little bit more state-of-the-arty, and it's trying to be cooler because it's Will Smith and he's cool and all that. But like, this movie is trying to have fun in a sandbox where it doesn't, to your point, Kenny, it's making fun of the right people. It's keeping that tone afloat. And there were apparently earlier cuts of this film that got an R rating, where I think there might have been more of the things that you were referring to, Felicia, of you know, alien dogs humping, and apparently there was like a doctor on board, and all of his stuff was basically cut because it was all a bunch of like proctology jokes and like probing jokes and like things that were just sort of like a little bit more blue and a little bit sort of like we don't and I think. You know, whether or not Dean Pariseau might have been a little bit pissed off about losing some fucks and shits and what have you in order to get the PG rating, the film is better off for it. I didn't need any of that stuff in this movie. I don't know how you guys felt about it.
No, when's I feel like funny? It's a very I love a good butthole joke. No, I mean that's I'm known for my butthole joke. So yeah.
And you want the butthole cut, obviously.
Yeah. Exactly. But I think when you're talking about cool, it's a very interesting thing because I think that word kind of goes back to what I think is endemically problematic and has institutionalized white male privilege in this industry, is that they're in power and they want to be cool with their friends. They want to show up to parties and say, oh, you made that cool comedy, that edgy comedy. And so that tonality becomes, it's a social phenomenon, but also a creative phenomenon in that those are the people in power picking the people who get to make things, right? And kindness is not cool to those dudes. Mm-hmm. So when, and that's why women increasingly get shoved into lower, you know, they go to indie films, they go to animation, you know, children's animation is, you know, so it's a very hierarchical thing where you can see people who are not white males being stacked up into the lower prestige, lower cool areas of entertainment. And that I think is inherently a problem. And you can't change that unless you have people in power who their cool is something different than that cool. And I don't think that's going to happen within my lifetime, but hopefully, you know, it's changing for the better. And 100%, I think the kindness and the PG-ness of it actually make it so much more appealing because you can just relax and be like, this is something we can all enjoy together. And it didn't feel lame for it, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, like, Kenny, you watched it with your son, right? And I know you show him R-rated movies anyway, but I do think that because you're a cool dad, you're like the coolest dad.
You're the cool dad.
Yeah, I'm the cool dad. That's right.
But didn't you feel a little bit? And I don't know how you feel about this as a parent watching it, but did you feel a little more at ease? Were you able to just kind of like just enjoy the film for what? Yeah,
nothing bad. I mean, I have like a newfound respect for filmmakers who go ahead and make a movie that's something you can watch with your kids. Yeah. I think that's great to have those movies, and I think it's great to know that nothing bad's going to happen within the context of the movie. I don't think that matters ultimately that much. I think this is a better movie for everybody because of it. I do. Mm-hmm. I think it's just a better movie. I think that there's something within every viewer knowing that it's not going to do something to you that makes you uncomfortable no matter what, that puts you at ease. Mm-hmm. I think that's okay. Like I like writing for, I'll put it this way. I started on a premium network and I'm currently on a premium network. And do whatever you want. I think that's terrible. I hate it because because people naturally go to places that don't necessarily serve the story and will put the audience ill at ease. Now, of course, there's some shows that need to be like that. Shows from The Sopranos to Succession to Game of Thrones. I get that. But I love having the guardrails up, not just as a writer, but as an audience member. I love knowing that this ride is not going to take me to a place. And just to use Tag as an example, Tag does not have to be R-rated. Tag is about grownups playing Tag. Okay. But because it's R-rated, I understand that they had a certain thing they wanted to do. They wanted to have adults be adults. So they wanted to say fuck and they wanted to drink. They wanted to have Jake Johnson be a stoner character. I get that. But because of that, they tacked on an entire miscarriage subplot to the third act of this movie. And once you have the R,
hilarious.
Not a go-to, guys. It's not a go-to.
It's unbelievable. And once you have the R rating on there, you almost feel like you have to do this crazy shit. But it takes you so far out of the movie.
But yeah. I'll tell you right now, like, I've produced a lot of animation. I've you know, I'm a producer on several animated projects. I've pitched so many times with animation. And and my number one feedback is it's not edgy enough or it's not kid enough. And this is actually, you know, that on top of pitching things where there's like, one time I remember pitching this project I love so much, and it was, it's Comedy Central, and the woman executive, when I mentioned the word vampire, she almost looked like I took a shit on the table because she hated geek stuff. They obviously don't think it's cool. And and at the same time, for animation, it's even more striated because you have to be so, you have to be able to watch it with an 8-year-old, or you have to have cartoons fucking. So like, there is no middle ground, which I think is actually that why anime is so popular, because anime actually is the middle ground because it's not being made in the States, which I think is, I think Netflix is probably, you know, the best at kind of breaking that barrier. But at the same time, still, it's very segmented into safe, unsafe. And I think that kind of colonization is the thing that ruins the opportunity to make something like this again.
I mean, yeah. I think that, you know, I certainly don't want to speak for you guys, but I know that when you sit down to write something, generally speaking, you don't put guardrails on yourself. You know, you want to just write it, see what comes, and you'll figure it out. You can, you know, pull yourself back or cut things, what have you. Something happened in this film, which I think is really interesting, which is in the, I guess they shot it even perhaps, which is that at the end of the film, when the spaceship crashes into the convention center, right? I remember thinking to myself, like, I feel like that would probably kill some people. Like, that looked really dangerous. Like, I remember thinking that.
Yeah.
And then reading that they shot a version of it where a couple people got decapitated by various things coming out of the ship. And I'm just like, that's just misreading the tone of this movie, right? Like, that's just thinking, let's just go for that. Like, let's go for the crazy. Like, I'm sure that there is a version of that where there's an audience for that, but like, you don't need it. Like, you just have to know where those, you know, where the needle is for the film. And I think they ultimately found it.
By the way, that's a pretty interesting little tidbit to me, because there's clearly a version of this movie that's like Peter Jackson pre Lord of the Rings, right? That is wild, right? There's so many, you know, when you bring aliens into the equation, anything can happen. When you're spoofing on Star Trek, anything can happen. And, you know, there's very few movies from 1999 I like more than South Park. So I'm certainly not afraid to enjoy a movie that roasts all the sacred cows. But just because you can doesn't mean you should, right? Mm-hmm. I really strongly do think there's more artistry in doing it without the crutch of let's cut some heads off, let's kill some people here, let's, you know, let's have a doctor who does anal probes because that's what you expect out of aliens. And I think what they found was something really artistic ultimately. Yep.
I think
it's so good. There's not one line that's wasted. There's not one character that isn't served. It's just, and it is kind. Like, there's not one nerd that you're like, oh, look at that stupid nerd. You're relating to every character, even one-liner people. And I think that's really sweet and something that you feel safe as an audience member. You're not being laughed at. You are laughing with it.
How about the sweetest moment of the whole movie being when Tim Allen tells Enrico Colantoni that he is the captain of this ship. He is the commander of this group. This guy, how did you find, I mean, he's my favorite actor anyway, but how did you find a character in Mathisar? How did you find that? Oh.
Yeah, Mathisar, I mean, it is, again, talk, and I'm sure you can speak to this better than we can, Felicia, but like, that's a real tone thing, right? Like, that tips into caricature and falls apart if you're not absolutely locked into the character. The way he laughs, the way he cries, like, all of this stuff is so close to being too much. You know, can you speak to that?
Yeah, sort of, but what I, that was no, like I mean, it was, I read on, when I was watching this on Amazon Prime, and mm-hmm. they have those little x-ray things, and it was like, that was done on set. The way he talked was not actually in the script. He came up with that, and they were like, oh, all the aliens should talk like that. And I thought that was really fascinating. Because as an actor, it's so hard to make a bold choice like that and not just fall flat in your face. And that's why actors have to be a little crazy, because it's like, I'm just going to do something crazy right now and hopefully you like it.
Yeah.
And you're not encouraged to do that in general because you're kind of on rails. Just do what you need to do and get through it. So the fact that he brought that, and I can't imagine him speaking normally, quote unquote, like a human being, and having it be as funny. And yeah, they're like SNL characters, but like because the writing serves them so well, mm-hmm. you actually feel super excited that Tony Shalhoub and, you know, what's her face get together at the end and like
Missy Pyle. Yeah.
Missy Pyle. I loved it, and it is really a class. I can't wait to show it to my daughter when she's 8 and doesn't watch R-rated movies.
Just don't run out like I did. I ran out too early.
So I just want to quickly. We've hit on a bunch of the plot, but just sort of the big moments of essentially, you know, the film opening in the convention center, which I love because you're seeing these actors that are just worn thin. They don't want to be doing this shit anymore. There's that amazing moment when Alan Rickman puts the trench coat over his head and tries to run out of there. Like, there's stuff like that that's great. I the conceit of the film is that, you know, Tim Allen is approached by these aliens at this convention. He thinks they're just fans or, you know, created some sort of thing. They teleport him to this spaceship. He thinks it's all a bit. He fires some missiles at a real alien spaceship and thinks that all is well. They teleport him back to Earth. He's obviously shaken by this crazy, weird teleportation device. He goes to the rest of his cast and says, you need to come with me. And then the entire cast is teleported up there. This is also one of my favorite Tony Shalhoub moments, when he gets teleported in and he goes, that was a hell of a thing.
It's also great. He misses all like the reveals there, right? He doesn't realize that they're like aliens who actually have these, you know, kind of Men in Blackian bodies under. So when he gets together with Missy Pyle, he has no idea he's getting together with a, you know,
so good.
Yeah, like an octopus person.
So I just want to quickly say, just to pause for a quick second and say, I saw this film in 99 at a theater at midnight with two friends. We knew nothing about this film. We were bored one night and we were like, what is this movie? It was at a multiplex in Toronto. We sat down really knowing nothing and just howled through the entire fucking thing. But the moment that really killed us is the moment that you just mentioned, Kenny, where Tony Shalhoub is kissing Missy Pyle, and then all of her tentacles start to come from under the frame. He's then pulled down, and just Sam Rockwell going, "Oh no, that's not right!" Like, it's just those jokes, which are, I don't know, like they're throwaways.
Yeah.
But the throwaways are gold in this movie. Unbelievable.
Also, how long is this movie? It's like an hour and a half, right?
It's like an hour 40, yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah. It'd be 2 hours and 20 minutes if it came out today.
It'd be 2 hours and 20 minutes now. And like, I'm tired. It's just tiring. It's just be a movie or be a TV show. I don't, you know, it's movies are out of control right now. They've lost their, what they should be. I don't know. If you're going to watch a comedy, it's just kind of, it's a disintegration of format in a way, but also this one made me admire it because it was so tight. It was so concise, but also beautifully crafted, and they got it done. They didn't keep everybody's cute improv at the end of the scene. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh my God, it's so funny. You know, just cut it. Okay.
Well, it's funny because I'm watching the AFI 100 with some friends every Saturday night as a pandemic thing on Zoom. And the thing that's hit us the most as we've been watching these films is they know when they're done. They get the fuck out when they're done. Like, the story's over. Credits.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much padding on movies today. So part of it is tempolitis and needing these set pieces that they spend $20, $30, $50 million on some crazy video game-esque action sequence that they can't pull from the movie now because it's too expensive. So it all just becomes just far too long. But mm-hmm. yeah, get out. The movie's done. They got to the convention center. It's over. Like, move on. Yeah.
We don't. And then they satisfied every character. Mm-hmm. Every single character had a great emotional arc within 1 hour and 40 minutes. It's just, God bless them.
They also, Guy's bit, which is that he's afraid that he's the red shirt that's going to die, is one of the best runners, because at one point he says, I wasn't even supposed to be here. I'm the sixth crew member. I'm clearly expendable. And then when they're when they're flying down to the rock planet, and he's like, I changed my mind. I want to go back. At first, I thought I was going to be the guy who dies on the ship, back on the ship. But now I think I'm the guy who's going to die on the planet. Like, it's just, it's great stuff.
I think they could have done even more with that. That is so funny and so rich, but Felice is making this point. I just want to kind of double down on it. It's not that hard
to establish emotional depth for your secondary characters. It's not that hard to start them here, have them learn something, have them conquer their fear, and have them end up here. Like you see it with Daryl Mitchell's character. In the beginning, he's faking how – that's such a good bit. He's faking how to how to drive the ship, and he's crashing against the wall. I mean, that's brilliant. And then he learns how to do it at the end.
Yeah, it's so funny.
It's so funny. And he's so great in that too. You know, I mean, like he – I mean, Daryl Mitchell is like – in a ton of shit when we were growing up. And, you know, he had a really bad accident. And he's now paralyzed from the waist down. But he's been in – I think he's been in every season of NCIS New Orleans. And he's had shows built around him. And he's a big advocate. And I think this is kind of important. He's a big advocate for actually casting differently abled people as people in those roles.
Oh, amazing.
It's interesting because he had a big career before – so he keeps getting cast in those roles, but so many people, you know, so many of those roles aren't cast with people who actually have the illness or have the disability that's, you know, portrayed in the show. So I think he's, you know, I think he's become like kind of a an important actor, an important person in this town as one of the foremost differently abled people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you mentioned one of his best bits is he, as they're trying to leave the station, he's scraping the ship along the side of the, and it goes on for so long. It's great stuff. They get to the rock planet. They see these cute aliens, and then aliens turn on one of the weaker ones and eats it.
But you just moment, you know why it's such a great moment? Mm. Because it hints at what these actors. Mm-hmm. are capable of destroying. It really in a tactile way gets you to understand what's at stake here. Okay, we didn't blow up the ship here because we were in a controlled environment. But if you let these idiots in charge of anything that can blow up or anything that could blow someone else up, we were fucked. I love it as a moment.
It's great.
Love it. Yeah.
It's also, I mean, I think that when those little aliens turn on the other one and eat it, it's also a moment when they realize that their lives are actually physically in danger. I mean, you then have Sigourney Weaver saying, quick, we have to go before one of those things eats Guy, which I think is great. Because
And that is great.
But like, it's just, and then we have sort of this, to your point, Kenny, and this is why like the script is so tight. It's that it's slowly but surely becoming more and more severe, right? Like the stakes are growing as the movie is progressing, right? Like at first they think it's a bit, and then it's like, oh, wait a second. And then they realize that everything is hinging on their performances from the show. So like Tony Shalhoub now has to teleport someone based on hand movements he did based on so nothing good. Back so when he good. Did the television show. Right. So it's like all of a sudden this phoned in performance that existed back, you know, however many years earlier is now a life or death situation. Like that's the genius of this movie.
It really, it's almost like, I don't know what kind of research, but it's like, you have to be inside the fan's head, the fan of the show's head. You need to be on set on one of these shows when people are bitching that they like half the actors who do this stuff, especially the information dump. I'm always hired as the girl who knows all the technical issues. And I do like monologues of technical stuff. Because I specialize in that. I'm really good at memorizing that stuff. But like how many times I've been on set where, how many times I've been on set where basically people do not know their lines at all because they keep going up on these things. Right. So every act, there's a lot of actors on these show where the mumbo jumbo comes in. They're like, and then the cue card. And so kind of highlighting that, it requires kind of an inside look, I think, on being on a set too. So I think it's just brilliant on so many levels.
It really, and on top of all of it, it's incredibly funny. Like we have the moment where Tony Shalhoub transports this alien creature onto the holodeck, but it's inside out and then it explodes. And there's this, so now you're just like, well, what are the chances that this is going to work? And then, you know, obviously he has to teleport Tim Allen, and you have this again speaks to the emotion, which is that Tim Allen's like, I trust you. I have faith in you. I know you can do this. Like, this is the stuff that, you know, it's layered and it's going for so much more than another movie, which would just kind of, you know, these are easy jokes, I guess, to some degree.
The other thing I really just, this is more of a general point, but just another thing that I love about this that you're speaking to is I think it's important when you're
when you come up with a premise, to find A stories, B stories, C stories, runners, everything that can only be told within the premise and the world yeah. that you have built. These yeah. are not things, these things we're talking about, they don't work anywhere else, but they mm-hmm. work so perfectly here. You could only tell the stories you're talking about, Felicia, in a movie like this. And yeah. in a movie specifically like this, because you couldn't have a believable world where aliens rebuilt the exact ship. It makes sense to them because they don't have any concept of our movies and TV. They just think they're historical documents. They just think these are actually your Earth's heroes. And it's so internally consistent that I love it so. I love it so much in terms of like everything within the story makes sense within this story. I'm like,
well, I think it's, a lot of the times it's like yeah. when you have a high concept kind of twist on something, it tends to, I know, you know, it tends to get very plot heavy, right?
Yeah.
And so I think because everything started from, okay, we have this twist, what would these characters actually have experienced and bring to this movie versus like, what do we want them to go through? And I think that was my problem with Star Trek. J.J. Abrams is fucking amazing, but like, for me, the modern Star Trek movies are very much like, well, they're not as based at much in character. It's all very much, you know, it's that sort of Hollywood character. You have the main dude who has a problem and then everyone's kind of serving him. And yeah. you have sort of like, oh yeah, let's give them something, but it's not organic and you don't invest in them. You're invested in the spectacle of it versus what Star Trek was to me and is to me is characters relating to each other, being family with problems, right? And that's not what the modern Star Trek movies are. They're wonderful and they're fun to watch, even though all the extras are white, if you notice, and all the men in authority extras are white men. Yeah. All the people in authority are white men extras. Watch yeah. it. But, you know, there are issues for me that Star Trek is not spectacle to me. It is character. Right. And I think mm-hmm. that's where Galaxy Quest got it so right. And Star Trek is a different beast.
I fully agree. Yeah, I would also say too that the concept that you're speaking of, like a high concept thing like this, I think today would have to answer all sorts of rules and questions, and it would get bogged down in explaining itself all the time.
Mm-hmm,
this
mm-hmm.
movie understands quite simply, like this is the premise there, and then you're off to the races, and you don't really need to explain anything anymore.
The rules are answered. The rules are answered. Yeah. The rules are answered in context. The rules are answered by people actually having to do things and then understanding that it's going to work this way or that way.
Yeah.
You don't have to have someone come out and say, these are the six things you have to understand about the world, which, by the way, I don't even hate when it does happen. I don't hate clarity. I'm totally down with clarity. But that's kind of a lesser form of storytelling. I think what you were talking to, Felicia, that really, really speaks to why this movie is so brilliant. All right, you take these characters, you put them in a situation that's completely beyond their control, a situation that has been – they're essentially mercenaries in a war between two other entities, right? Mm-hmm. And they're living in a simulation almost controlled by one of them. Yet the entire story is driven by the decisions of our characters. It's all driven by people we care about. And that is the genius, and that's what's so instructive about this movie from a writing and a filmmaking standpoint. It's yes, things can happen to a character. Yes, characters can react, but when you're getting into the meat of the narrative, you have to have the people you care about driving the story and making decisions.
I would also say too, to that point, to piggyback on what both of you are saying, is that the jokes also help tell the rules of the universe. I mean, you have that great moment when they're like talking about Gilligan's Island and Mathisar's like, good. Those poor souls. You know what I mean? So like right there, you're like, well, it's not just this show. They think all television shows are historical documents. Right.
And yeah, I love that. I love that. Yeah. Well, it's also like, I think, I don't know if you guys, I fantasize a lot about time traveling and realize how mm-hmm. shitty it would be because I love reading history more than anything. Uh-huh. But it would, as a woman, like, don't do it. It's a terrible
sure.
idea.
Sure, sure.
But I'm always like, wow, who would be, and I'm like, oh, a time travel show or a book is so fun. What would be the best person to time travel back? And you're like, okay, Bear Grylls would probably be a good one. But would sure. you want to see a person who played a cave person in a bad play. That's more fun. That's the comedy thing. Sure. Or you do a drama of Bear Grylls going back to like caveman times.
Yeah. I'd watch that. Yeah.
I would watch both of those because I really like time travel. Okay. For the record.
Yeah, I love time travel. The best.
We're centrally at the end here. But earlier in the film, we have the moment when Jason bumps into Brandon and they swap communicators. So now at the end of the film, Jason realizes that he has a way to communicate with Brandon, who's played by Justin Long in his first movie role. Wow. And he's fantastic in it. And now you have sort of, and this kid is now the key to them surviving this entire ordeal. And he walks them through the ship's core and how to sort of what he thinks the Omega 13 is, which is essentially a time travel. Speaking of your favorite thing, Felicia, a time travel device.
Quantum Leap. Why is there not a redo?
That's a very good question.
It doesn't make any sense.
I have questions about that. But I do think that there's sort of this great moment when they're walking through and Brandon's like, I can't believe you're actually seeing the Omega 13. Like, it must be beautiful. And they're like, I don't know what you're talking about. It's just a fan. And then they look up and they see this beautiful coil of I guess, matter, time travel matter of some sort. And then he walks them through this thing. And I'm curious about your thoughts here, because this is really the only time when they go to this well, and I'm appreciative of it, which is they walk into this room where there's these chompers or these fucking giant metal things that are there for no other reason than just because it will look cool on television and it's a good thing for them to get through. And then Sigourney Weaver screams, she clearly screams, fuck that, but they bleep over it and she says, screw that, or something like that.
Yeah.
And Gwen says, this episode was very badly written. The person who wrote this should die.
Love it.
Now, I love that joke. The reason I bring it up is I think in a weaker film, they would have gone to that well a lot more. A lot more of the, like, you know, winking at the camera, acknowledging that somebody wrote this television show, acknowledging all those sort of things. And I love that they don't do that.
But I think it's their journey is appreciating what they have a little bit more. You know what I'm saying? All of them, because a lot of them are not wanting to be there, not, you know, don't think highly of what they've done in their career. And having that fan help show them how awesome it is. What that's almost like a reversal in a way that I think is really sweet. Mm-hmm. And so, that sort of self-referential stuff is less, thank God it's a little bit less, like, because then you're really getting meta. And people don't really, I know, my cousin doesn't know how I work. They don't understand why I don't work every day. They're like, well, she was busy for a couple of years. What happened? You know, like, they don't understand how, they're like, why does it take so long, you know? So people don't really understand. They don't really care, right? They know actors, but they only know them. They don't need to get into the nitty gritty of it.
Yeah.
So I think that they did, like you said, like, I don't know how as an actor you trim all these different layers and then make perfection without like going off in one direction that's too much. And maybe it was in the script and they narrowed it down. It was just masterful editing. In a way.
Well, I would also say too that, you know, Kenny and I, and I don't know how you feel about the movie Scream, Felicia. I don't know if you're a fan or not a fan of that movie.
I don't watch a lot of scary movies. I enjoyed it, but neither I remember seeing it, and I think I went in the theater at the time. I was like, oh, this is fun. It's like funny, scary, because I don't like horror films.
But I think there's a version of this movie that's as much of a commentary on Star Trek.
Yes.
And I don't necessarily think that movie's bad. But I'm just glad they didn't.
Very self-aware.
Yeah. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, go ahead,
I think Kenny. I think that Scream is what Scream should be, and Galaxy Quest is what Galaxy Quest could be.
Yeah.
A good satire or a good spoof functions also as a good version of the thing that it's satiring or spoofing. Yeah, I would go so far as to say I think Scary Movie functions as a good horror movie in its own
way. That's a good movie. I'm sorry. It's fun. I think it is.
And I think it has an interesting kind of fun twist ending. Like that they put thought in beyond like what would be the silliest thing to happen. So I think that it would be weird, to me at least, if Star Trek was dealt with the way Scream is dealt with. But I also love the Justin Long twist on it, because I think that is wish fulfillment in its own way.
Yeah.
When he's the fanboy.
Yeah. And when you're really on the inside of these fandoms, it stops actually being about enjoying the piece of art or the serialized thing that's happening. And it starts being about writing fan fiction in your head
or writing mm-hmm. fan fiction actually in real life. And the dream is to be up inside of it the way he was at the end of this movie. The fact yep. that he thinks it's real, like, or that I think is a little misunderstanding of what fans yep. feel, but to mm-hmm. actually be able to affect the narrative, that's yep. a fucking dream. So I think that's yep. really, really cool.
Yeah, and they did yeah, it in I mean, a way and that essentially didn't make him
they're,
feel
they're
like
able to crash the plane into. Yes, very true. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying they crashed. Yeah, I know everything they did with that character was empathetic and not mm-hmm. feeling, it's a nerd. They have posters in their well and they're over 20, you know, like that kind of yeah. thing, which mm-hmm. is so, you know, for me, I've tried to sell many, many, I don't pitch TV anymore as a writer because I'm just like, I'm done. I can't be rejected anymore. But so many times I try to pitch female characters who are fans of things, right? And I'll get really close and then I'm like, I really think they truly don't understand that there's a huge contingent out there who would love to see themselves in a movie like that. And yet, I think, especially when mainstream Hollywood looks at fans, they look at an other to be either exploited or kind yep. of made fun of
sure.
In a way from a Big Bang perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly treating Justin Long's character like a Big Bang character would have taken the heart away from this movie. And I really appreciate that about it.
Well, sometimes it's hard.
Sometimes
it's hard, I think, for Hollywood to lose sight of its or to distance itself from its roots, right? The roots mm-hmm. of Hollywood are it's carnivals and it's things like that. And the audience are marks. The audience are rubes. The audience are morons who buy into this shit and who are willing yep. to spend money on your fakery. What's happened over the last 120 years is those rubes and marks and morons became the ones who are actually writing the stuff. And the ones who are actually in the stuff and the ones who are actually directing and producing the stuff. And right. the people who we find so detestable are the people who forget that they were once, you know, the consumers of these products. They were once Justin Long. They were, you know, like that. The people who now look down their nose at fans, it's insane to me. You know, and I've said this many times on this podcast. All we're doing is writing stories for the people who actually sure. like our shit. That's all you're doing. To look down your nose at the people who actually like your shit and paying you for it, you're a monster.
You're an idiot. Yeah, you're a monster. I think there's two Justin Long moments that I just wanted to highlight really quickly. The first is when he first gets contacted by Jason on the communicator, and Brandon's like, and Jason says, "I'm sorry if I was curt with you earlier." And Brandon's like, "It's okay. I mean, I get it. I'm not an idiot. Like, I know it's not real." And he's like, "Actually, it's all real." He's like, "I knew it." Like, I think
I like that.
Great about that exchange. I also love that right in the middle of when the shit's hitting the fan, it cuts to him taking the garbage out because his mom forces him to take the garbage out. And it's just like, it's just really sweet. Like, it's funny and it's yeah. sweet. It's just, it's really good. I also think that it's worth highlighting here. You know, in some of my reading, this was obviously a DreamWorks movie, and I think that Spielberg took an interest in this script or an interest in this project, and you do sense that unlike something like Shrek, which is so jaded and so snarky about everything, you could sense Spielberg's fingerprints on this a little bit in terms of all of that sort of stuff, of the big-heartedness of it. But yeah, I mean, so basically the ship crashes into the convention center. They all come out of the ship and the fans think that this is all part of the show. They incinerate the bad guy with a Love ray it. Gun, which is great. And Jason obviously pulls the whole cast onto the sort of to the front of the stage with him, and you recognize sort of the family component of it, and then we get this sort of promo for the sequel to the movies or the show that would go on in the future, and Sam Rockwell has a ridiculous character name,
so good.
It's great,
so good,
and yeah, I mean it's really great, and you know I did a bit of reading. The film was
I got choked up. I got you when Sam Rockwell gets the and, you get choked up.
It's
awesome.
It's great. I did a little bit of reading, and you know, I think a few years ago there was an announcement, and it might still be that Paul Scheer is doing an Amazon TV show based on this.
I saw that. It was a couple years ago, so I don't know if that's
still happening.
I will say that the most depressing thing to do, guys, as an actor, is to watch Amazon Prime with that X-ray thing and look at all the day players in every single one of these movies around 99, 2000, whatever. And you click on their IMDb, and every okay, maybe two or three break out. Most of them have a clearly a commercial headshot on there. And they're still sticking around, but they have not worked since 2002. It is so depressing.
It's real grim. I suggest grim. You not watch things with the X-ray thing on.
I know, but I can't say. I was like, where are they now? Why? God. She had one line. Where is she now? I'm like, oh, no, she did it at Law & Order guest star in 2007, and that's it. I'm like, oh, no.
Don't put yourself through me. That.
Yeah. When you start when you start doing it with like the executive story editors on the shows you like, then you know you've really gone too far.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Or director. I actually worked with a director earlier in my career, and he hasn't worked in 15 years. And I was like, thank God. But rarely, rarely that happened.
So at the end of our episodes, Felicia, we do a rating system where we rate the film from 0 to 99, 0 being the lowest, 99 being the highest. We rate it from back in 99, then we rate it before we did this podcast, and then we rate it after the podcast if the podcast changed your opinion in one way or another. I know it's a lot of numbers. I'll go first.
Wait, what?
And
okay.
You'll understand.
You go first. Yeah, I'll okay. First. You'll, okay,
it's,
do it.
It's first.
Yep.
In 99, as I mentioned, I saw this at midnight with a group of friends, and it was one of my favorite movie-going experiences ever. I probably would have given it a 90 back then, maybe even a 92. Like, I loved it. And the film has really honestly only grown in my esteem. I think I'm at, like, a 94 now, maybe even a 95. Like, I think it's my favorite comedy of 99. And I know that Being John Malkovich and Election are probably considered comedies, but they're obviously much more. Not to say that Galaxy Quest isn't, but, like, pure laughs, pure comedy. Like this is my favorite comedy of 99, I think. Kenny, do you want to go?
Sure. I don't think I saw this in 99, but I saw this pretty soon after, probably like 02, 03. I always thought it was great, a great movie to like kind of put on. I never would have given it anything like I'm about to give it. So I think it was probably around 77, 78. I thought it was just good. I loved watching it last night. I loved watching it with my kid. The only thing I would say is I think the second act is a little slow, and I do think that you do kind of lose focus a little bit. Not that much. First act so strong, third act so strong, character so strong. I'm going to give it a 91. I'm going to keep at a 91. It is not my favorite comedy of the year. It's not Office Space to me, but it's a tremendous movie. 91's very good.
Yep.
I don't have any context to rate anything, all right? But I will say that I think I watched this before I was involved in geeky productions and I had my career. I probably watched it when I was more into like dark or indie films. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, you know, Little Miss Sunshine. Like, I was more of an indie film kind of girl.
Sure.
And so I think that I probably love this more, way more now than I would have when I first saw it in like 2002 or three on like DVD or VHS, not VHS, not all that. I'm not that old. I look very good for my age too. Yeah. Well, you know,
you look great for an elf that's wearing a hat and you got a little, that's right. Yeah.
So anyway, I would give this is probably one of my top 10 comedies. For me, 1999 is okay. I'm a 1939 gal, so sure. If you ever do another series, I think 1939. Oh,
we're doing Patreons.
We're on 80. Do that. We're doing 89 on Patreon right now, and in fact,
oh, nice.
It's coming up very soon. But if we keep going back on the nines, we'll get you back here from Wuthering Heights.
Oh, Wuthering Heights,
Wizard of Oz.
We'll get you back here for you know,
Wizard of Oz. I mean, some of the best
Ninotchka. Right?
Oh,
Garbo.
So many travels. Now I'm going to look. Oh my God. Hunchback of Notre Dame. Yeah. Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
Yeah.
The Women of Mice 39's and Men. A hell of a year. God.
You know, The Women didn't have a single male character. Every single character in The Women was a woman.
That's great.
Oh, that's interesting.
Everyone.
Never really thought about that. Yeah, there's so many. Oh, Gugga Din. This is Dark Victory. Jeez, there's a lot of good movies.
Those are two problematic movies right there.
Anyway, So next week, we are covering The Iron Giant. We have Emily Vanderwerf and Libby Hill coming on.
That's one of my favorite movies ever.
What are your thoughts on The Iron Giant? This was a window
never
for you.
Never cried harder than in that movie.
Really?
No. That movie, but I cried in Babe, Pig in the City. Like, if that's my go-to.
I love Babe, Pig in the City.
On if I'm on set and I need to cry, I will listen to Babe, Pig in the City. That song, James Cromwell. Oh. I met James Cromwell once. I shook his hand and I started weeping openly. I am not exaggerating. And he looked at me like he did not think it was appropriate.
I don't believe you. I think he probably thought it was just fine.
He looked at me very strangely, you guys. It was not a common reaction.
Did you give him context? Or did he just think you were weeping?
I just really love Babe. And I was like, he was like, I thought I was meeting a professional. Like,
oh, you're a professional. So, but the Iron Giant, Felicia, what is it that you love about the Iron Giant as we wrap this up?
I mean, it's the most heartfelt. I can't deal with anthropomorphic people, like creatures pass, you know, like I don't want to spoil anything, but
just a spoiler.
when they're in peril, sure, that is the most heart-wrenching movie. I'm not kidding. That, and the only time I've ever cried more was, remember that, and this is a really terrible thing to admit, but I went with my mom to, remember that Michael Keaton movie Life?
Yes, sure, with Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
Just like a total manipulative piece of shit movie.
He's
I
dying
cried
the whole
so
movie, right?
hard. Yes.
Yeah.
He just dies of cancer and has a bit. Like, it's just the, like, why? And I've never cried harder than in those two movies. Iron Giant.
You know what a good, anthropomorphic machine man thing in peril movie is?
Terminator 2?
No. No one really acknowledges it. But I love it. Have you guys seen Big Hero 6?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, that's good.
It is.
I didn't cry.
So
but yeah, it's good.
Beautiful in its own way, and I think it. I see like a direct line from Iron Giant to Big Hero 6.
Sure. Yeah. So Felicia, do you cry a lot at movies? No judgment. I'm just curious as to whether.
No,
or not
I don't like crying. Okay. I don't like crying on camera. I have to be paid a lot of money to cry on camera, and I
you don't like showing emotion.
It's. You know, I've been to a lot of therapy. It's a little bit better now. Yeah. No. Okay. I don't like crying, and I don't like watching tear jerky things. I want to watch either baking shows or comedies or genre shows that I can binge. You know what I'm saying? So
that's fair.
I don't have the highest class taste, but I'm excited. I will listen to your Iron Giant because
that's
seminal.
Fantastic.
Work.
I was a crying child. I was like one of those children who cried, like as part of his personality until I was about 12 or 13. And I no longer can cry. And it's horrible. It's like...
Was it something that people did to you because you were a crier? You labeled yourself? Because you're already labeling yourself.
I think that's what happened. I think at some point I resolved to never cry again. And it's like... Or it's like Trump, where Trump says, you know, you only have a certain amount of energy in your life, so don't exercise. Only have a certain amount of tears
you got rid
in
of
your...
them all.
Maybe you only have a certain amount of tears in your life, and they're gone. Mm-hmm. But it's very... I love
honest,
crying,
guys.
And it's very hard for me to cry.
I cry fairly often, certainly in a pandemic, I'm going to be honest. And a good cry, guys, it's a great release, I got to tell you.
No, it's true. Good. I can't cry right now. No, I can't. Yeah. I don't know if it's something about I've been shut down.
I sneeze.
COVID, yeah.
I get plenty of sneezes, so I'm good.
Well, Felicia, thank you so much for coming on to talk about Galaxy Quest with us.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you. You guys were so fun.
It was awesome.
It was a blast to rewatch this movie, and I can't wait to show it to my baby, like I said, when she's a little bit older.
And we hope that you'll come back for something else maybe in the future. I'll shoot you some stuff maybe. And
let me know.
But
come back for an 89er.
For 89.
39.
Or 39, whatever it is.
In 30 years, you guys are going to get back there.
We're going to do 39.
We'll get there. But thank you. Thank you again.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too.
Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.